staff. Close the door. Thank you. Unfortunately, Walter Benjamin is the one in the deck chair. That would be nice, actually, if he were the other. Thank you. So we've been looking at capitalist modernity to date in terms of the qualitative transformation that it brings about, the fact that it changes the world, it makes the world anew. So it's not simply a question of there being a new dominant mode of production. In a strict sense, the capitalist world is not the same place as the pre-capitalist world. And this is, I suppose, the point that David Harvey helped us to understand by focusing on the fact that the time and space come to mean rather different things under different material conditions. So it's not only a matter of the objective content of the material world, but also of subjectivity or experience. And the best summary for this, I think, is that rendered in Marx and Engels' formulation that we looked at last week, in which they speak of the constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions. Right. And then go on to speak of this, all fixed, frozen, fast frozen relations are swept away, all new formed ones become antiquated, and so on before they can ossify. So a full discussion of modernity therefore needs to include more than the analysis of capitalism narrowly conceived as a mode of production. We have to think of urbanization, technology, bureaucracy, experience, by which I think is specifically meant the shock of the new, the change in subjectivity that corresponds to the change in objectivity. And we begin to get a full discussion of these factors with Walter Benjamin, who lives from 1892 to 1940, when he commits suicide on the Franco-Spanish border, just one step ahead of the Gestapo from whom he's fleeing. He thinks very deeply about capitalism in its experiential, psychological, subjective aspects. We might think about Benjamin in relationship to other modern or modernist thinkers or artists of his time. Just to take one, Le Corbusier, probably the greatest 20th century architect and certainly the most influential. In the 1920s, Le Corbusier reflecting on the sea change between the old world and the new. We shouldn't take him literally, Marshall Berman begins, but rather understand his narrative as a modernist fable. This is Corbusier. It begins on a boulevard, specifically on the Champs-Élysées, on an Indian summer eve in 1924. He's gone for a peaceful walk in the evening twilight, only to find himself driven off the street by traffic. This is a half century after Marx and Dickens and Baudelaire, and the automobile has arrived on the boulevard's full force. It was as if the world had suddenly gone mad. From moment to moment, he felt the fury of the traffic grow. Every day increased its agitation. Corbusier feels himself threatened and vulnerable in the most direct way. To leave our house meant that once we crossed our threshold, we were in danger of being killed by the passing cars. Shocked and disoriented, he contrasts the street and the city of his middle age with that of the youth before the First World War. And we already saw this with Benjamin talking about the shock of the people who had gone to the war and who came back and everything seemed to be changed. I think back 20 years, Corbusier writes, to my youth as a student, the road belonged to us then. We sang in it, we argued in it, while the horse bus flowed softly by. Look at the Place Clichy, circa 1890 here, horse-drawn carriages, rather few people on the street, just contrast it with 1925, and obviously if you scroll forward, I mean the Place Clichy has been changed now, the central roundabout is no longer there, it's a huge traffic intersection, basically. I mentioned Marshall Berman let me just also focus on the fact, so this person who is commenting on the shock of the new, on the radical transformation across these years from, I mean, in this case, 1890 to 1925, is the person who produces this kind of architecture. So we have in their thinking, not a way of looking backwards, but in fact, this sense of this is a definition of modernism in architecture, sleek geometry, the sort of the rendering geometrical of space in some sense, the use of squares and circles, the idea of geometric space. We see obviously an analogy between what's happening in this kind of building, in the construction of this building, and what happens in poetry, in literature, in painting generally. So the fact that Corbusier is disoriented in some sense by the new doesn't mean that his art looks backwards. It's not a nostalgic kind of art, on the contrary. So I mentioned Marshall Berman because it's Berman who gives us this discussion of Corbusier, and Berman's great book that I'm quoting from here is taken from Marx, obviously, that all that is solid melts into air, the experience of modernity Berman is writing about. And now Benjamin gives us similar descriptions throughout his work. In an essay on Charles Baudelaire, he wrote a lot about Baudelaire, incidentally. He described him as a symptomatically contradictory figure. Baudelaire writing in the mid-19th century. Benjamin described him as what he called a lyric poet in the era of high capitalism. And we're meant to hear a disjunction there. In some sense, what he suggests, obviously, that lyric poetry is rendered obsolete by high capitalism. Something about the world of the lyric poet, of lyric poetry. Let us think, for instance, of Keats as one kind of example of the lyric poet. There are many others we could focus on. But that world, what makes Keats' world intelligible for us, or makes it a world as a whole, rather than just a set of random impressions. The world out of which lyric poetry comes is contradicted by the lived reality of high capitalism, which is why for Benjamin, Baudelaire is such an interesting and such a contradictory figure. Baudelaire goes for a walk, for instance, and he sees a swan in the gutters in Paris. And you can see how he's going to immediately think of this. What is a swan doing in the gutters? It unnerves him. In some sense, a swan seems to register a different kind of world, rural, more tranquil, slower. It's in danger of being run over, killed, etc., on the streets of Paris. And this kind of juxtaposition in Baudelaire is so characteristic of his poetry. And Benjamin particularly draws out those aspects. So contrast the what Benjamin is drawing attention to. Look, for instance, at Friedrich Engels, Marx's co-writer, writing. This is in 1843. And what you find, as in Le Corbusier, as in Engels, you find a revulsion. A sense of the city as somehow, let's use that word, dehumanizing, as it's often used. The sense of the city falsifies the earlier kind of social being. And I'm mentioning this because I want to draw the strongest possible comparison between this kind of thinking, or Corbusier's, in the old days, the good old days, as it were, as distinct from the bad new days. Benjamin is not nostalgic. He doesn't look back in this kind of way. What we have here is an older sensibility, being shocked or being horrified or being recoiling from the new. So the brutal indifference, the unfeeling isolation of each person in his private interest becomes the more repellent and offensive, and so on. Here in Northumberland Street, Newcastle, obviously this is 150 years or 180 years after Engels is talking, but that particular sense of the atomization, the isolation, of registered as for Engels and for Corbusier, as a massive problem, as a kind of falsification, as an assault on the senses, in some way. Benjamin is sensitive to that, but that's not his identification. That's not what he thinks about here. One of the things that makes him truly remarkable is his sensitivity to both the violence of change in the modern world and its ineluctability, the fact that there can be no going back. Change is always happening and always about to happen. He liked to quote Bertolt Brecht's slogan. Here he is playing chess with Brecht. Brecht, a great friend of Benjamin's, in the 1930s. Don't start from the good old days, but the bad new ones. And you see that Engels, going back here, Engels starts from the good old days. Something repulsive about the position from which he starts is that it used to be rather different. Today, that's no longer possible. Both Brecht and Benjamin want to start from the bad new days, as it were. Benjamin is acutely conscious, not merely of the transience of things. Of course, the idea of the transience of things is a very old idea. Where have they gone, etc. You know, that's a very, very, that this kind of writing dates back to Old English, or to you know, 6th, 5th century, and probably even before. Certainly it's there in the Greeks and the Romans, this idea of where have the earlier generations gone, of how they've lapsed. So it isn't that that Benjamin is focusing on. He doesn't, he's not talking about impermanence or mortality and so on. But rather what he directs our attention to is that so much of what surrounds us and enters into our experience, individual and collective experience, is disappearing second by second. So this acute awareness of what every second is being eclipsed, is being invisibilized, disappearing. But also for Benjamin, what is then coming into existence. He's astonishingly aware of those two dimensions, as it were, of the radically new, of the inventions all around. At the same time, this awareness of loss, of the disappearance of certain aspects that marks his work very profoundly. So many aspects of our lives, objective, subjective, social, customary, existential, dreams and reality, fantasy and memory, are being rendered obsolete, are eclipsed, they're made extinct. Benjamin's always talking about the dangers and the possibilities represented by this. Everything in his world is always on the verge of obliteration and oblivion. It gives his writing an astounding kind of urgency, partly because he thinks that the critic or the historian or whatever category you want to use for this figure of the theorist in some way, the task of the theorist, as it were, is to register, record all of those things before they disappear. Each feeling that you have will not be there tomorrow. So it's really important to register it, record it for posterity, perhaps. We'll look at this more next week when we begin to talk about Benjamin's very strange idea about what history is. I don't mean what the past is, I mean what writing history is. What is involved in historical thinking, in the idea of historical thought. So he's fascinated in his work by concatenation, by simultaneity, not by seriality, not linearity. Reversibility interests him, but and rupture interests him, but not progressivism or historicism, as he calls it. He says he hates the kind of history, we'll look at this next week, he hates the kind of history that goes from one thing to another, as it were. He says that historians often talk about history like somebody telling the beads of a rosary, one, two, three, etc. That's not what history is for Benjamin. Because that of course just suggests that one day is like any other day, etc. He's trying to get rid of that. Go back to how I began the module with David Byrne and Talking Heads, this idea of the shock of the new. And the category of shock is central to Benjamin in his thinking about the experience of modernity. He had read Freud's papers dealing with war neurosis, with what after the First World War was called shell shock. Well, I suppose we would call it post-traumatic stress disorder today. But this idea in Benjamin is that post-traumatic stress disorder is the normal condition. In some sense, we are all suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So he goes further to argue that I'm taking this from a wonderful essay by Susan Buck Moores, which is called, I've chopped off the bottom there unhelpfully, Aesthetics and Anaesthetics. And she's talking about the fact that in some sense, in order to just walk around the streets, to be abroad, to be in the world, in New York City, in London, in Shanghai, etc., you need to develop this kind of sense of a kind of carapace. You need to be anesthetized. Because if you're not, you're constantly being subjected to this dizzying numbers of shock, which the human sensorium cannot absorb. So you have to, as it were, develop a kind of set of shock absorbers here. So the mimetic capacities are used as deflection against it. The smile that appears automatically wards off contact, a reflex that functions as a shock absorber, a mimetic shock absorber, is the suggestion. And Benjamin is interested in these two things. What is the aesthetic that comes out of that anaesthetic in some sense? The technologically altered environment exposes the human sensorium to physical shocks that have their correspondence in psychic shock, as Baudelaire's poetry bears witness. So factory work, for example, the factory system, as Benjamin puts it, injures every single one of the human senses and paralyzes the imagination of the worker. Work is sealed from experience. Memory is replaced by conditioned response. Learning is replaced by drill. Skill is replaced by repetition. Practice counts for nothing. Look again, moving forward from the 1920s, this obviously just a production line there. Here, an accounting office in Brooklyn. You see the fragmentation of space, obviously we know about time on the clock, etc., etc., but the use of computers, the de-individualization, or let us scroll forward to a contemporary office space, very similar. So in his celebrated essay, the one we're looking at here on the work of art in the age of its technological reproducibility, Benjamin is concerned with the implications of capitalist modernization for culture. And it's necessary, he says, to propose some theses defining the tendencies of the development of art under the present conditions of production. The changes in the material bases of society, he says, development and implementation of new productive forces and so on, have had decisive effects on consciousness. All of this has massive implications for art. That's what mostly interests Benjamin. So we're thinking already of three categories arranged in order. Modernization, which is the development and the implementation of productive forces. So the one new technologies, et cetera, new plant, new also new social relationships, et cetera. But then think of the category of modernity. So modernization, modernity. Modernity is then maybe best thought about as the kind of the air that we breathe in that world, in that transform. That is modernity in some ways. And then think thirdly of the category of modernism. Modernism is the cultural response to those other two things. When it speaks of modernist art, so what is the attitude of modernist art to modernity or to modernization? Sometimes, as we would imagine, modernist art says no to modernity. It hates modernity. It hates the idea of modernization. Sometimes modernist art loves the idea of modernization and seizes on it and imagines the poetic subject as an aeroplane, for instance, or a helicopter, or something that can fly in certain ways. But always we're talking about that set of relations: modernism, modernity, modernization. Always think of those terms together in some way. So, for example, says Benjamin, creativity and genius, he says, have been rendered obsolete as categories, and also the idea that cultural works have eternal value and that they are ineffable. So the sense of Benjamin is no longer interested in the idea of the poet, of the artist as a genius. That sense has been, he says, that relates to an old world. Nowadays, in some sense, one has moved to the idea of the author as producer. If you think of how ensemblistic film is, film's a collective medium, almost by definition. Of course, we know about auteur theory, which is a desperate attempt in some way to hold on to the idea of the director as a kind of genius in the way in which Shakespeare was a genius. But Benjamin suggests that film as a medium works against that. Film doesn't have geniuses. It has combines. It has ensembles. It has collectives. And he suggests that all of culture is moving in that direction. Factual material manipulated the interests of fascism. He wants to put a spoke in the idea of that. On the other hand, they're useful for the formulation of revolutionary demands. And we notice as we're reading that Benjamin tends often, for his examples in this essay at least, he privileges architecture. What he's trying to describe, he says, is most obvious with regard to building. So he's interested in some way in talking about the opening up of imagination and of possibility. In some ways, what we might describe as democratization, but democratization of the imagination in some way rather than formal democracy. He's writing in a context, though, of increasing monopolization and fascism. He wants his ideas about art to be, as he puts it, useless for the purposes of fascism. He wants to produce ideas about culture which fascism cannot use. And he has in mind certain buildings, for instance. So this is Bauhaus, Gropius's Dessau. The thing is, it's very easy to see how this modernist building, built in 1925 to 28, becomes usable for fascism. Not only, of course, the metaphor here of the wire on the outside, but just that sense of the block in some way. Look at it at another building here. This is from the 1920s. The big market hall in Frankfurt. And you can see here when we see a building like this, we already think in some way of collectivization, of the idea of people being massified and made into a herd. in some way, which of course is what fascism does to people. So Benjamin is opposed to that kind of building. Contrast that kind of building, if you like, with Corbusier's that we looked at earlier. Benjamin is particularly interested in buildings that don't make themselves available for that kind of appropriation. He talks at one point about Tatlin's great idea of a monument. Here's this is a building that never got built, partly because it would have been impossible to build it. But it's a design for the tower of the Third International. You can see the difficulties of making that building. But this is a building which is radically futuristic, 1920s and so on. I mean, it seems already to be a kind of a spaceship. But this sense of certainly after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, so many architects tried to build spaces for people to live and shop in that looked something like this, as it were. Not at all the buildings of the big sort of people-holding buildings, like the Humanities Block that we have. This building is usable for fascism. Benjamin wouldn't have... it was not meant to be a fascist building. It's meant, on the contrary, building for the humanities. It's meant to house us and so on. But you can see how it could be appropriated. Benjamin wants us to be in buildings that can't be appropriated. So that's what he has in. A lot of these theses or ideas come together in the famous thesis in this essay about the withering of the aura. So let's just look for a moment here at the two frameworks. He's suggesting that in some ways, just as lyric poetry has disappeared, its conditions of possibility have been undermined. So that if you have lyric poetry today, what is it? Can it be understood as lyric poetry? Can you write lyric poetry today? Or is lyric poetry just today an echo of itself? Because the kind of people that would be positioned in relation to lyric poetry no longer exist. And this is, Benjamin is suggesting this through this idea of the aura. So grounded in a single unique location, on the other hand, freed from constrictions of space and time. And so on, derived from the order of nature, a mountain range. If we think, for instance, of romanticism, most notably the idea of the sublime, for instance, which we encounter and we continue to think as most difficult. If you think about what romantic poetry understands it's doing in its description of the Alps and so on, how do the Alps relate to us as people? How do those sublime landscapes, and what is art supposed to be? Is art a romantic poem about an experience of being in the mountains in some way? Of course, it's an objectification. A poem is an objectification, but it's meant to be a kind of a human expression of that immensity in some ways. That's what the sublime is in a particular sense. And Benjamin is arguing that's not possible any longer. On the contrary, but don't say to yourself, the good old days in which you could write romantic poetry. Rather focus on the bad new ones in which you can't and say, what's possible from here? What does the contemporary form of experience make possible? How do we do things in this space? So the category of aura, he says, is introduced in terms of the here and now of a work of art, its unique existence in a particular place. The originality and authenticity of the artwork is fundamental to its uniqueness. The authenticity of a thing is the quintessence of all that is transmissible in it from its origin on, ranging from its physical duration to its historical testimony. Relating to it. I'm trying to think of contemporary, it's difficult to think this with regard to literature, of course, because literature since the Gutenberg moment, literature hasn't been technologically reproduced. Very few of us, it's almost impossible that you could read the manuscript of we all read, we read paperbacks, we read online, and so on. We're talking about the technological mediation of art forms. In literature, that's been the way in which we've thought. I mean, many people have said that Benjamin's work seems strangely out of date because he's focusing on the visual so much in this essay. But if you focus on the literary, when does literature begin to be technologically mediated? And the answer is probably in the 16th century or something. When I was teaching in the States, in the creative writing program with two people, Keith and Rosemary Wardrop, and they were experimental poets, they're still alive. But they had this amazing house, which is structurally unsound because of the weight of books, the number of books they had. They had more books than I've ever seen in my whole life. The first time I went into their house, I saw this immensity of books on all that. Keith had ripped out all of the old bookcases and replaced them with those very small bookcases that fit just a paperback book, ceiling to floor in every single room. So I saw all these books and I went up and I realized after about 15 minutes of looking at them, this was just A to C. In other rooms. Anyway, when they leave the house, it's going to have to be torn down because the weight of the books has made the foundations of the house structurally unsound. Anyway, the point is not this. The point is that they used so they would write their poems. Keith had built a printing press, and it operated downstairs, and he would winch out maybe 50, maybe as many as say 300 copies of their poems and they would give those to their friends. So I'd get a copy made, lithographs by Rosemary or by Keith. They would be there. But now, so this kind of work, you could say, still had aspects of that, consumed by the isolated individual, value derived from tradition, artwork's continuity with the past, authority derives from the artifact. Because they became fairly well known, Rosemary particularly became a well known poet, and her work was sometimes reviewed in the New York Review of Books and so on and so forth. But who had a Rosemary Wardrop text? She would write a novel. You know, there were only 300 or 400 copies in existence. She wouldn't allow them to be put out by major imprints. So in a certain sense, it was all about word of mouth and so quite different then from even the, we're not talking about the mass sellers here, but even the privileged, the person who's a well-known, David Foster Wallace, for instance, a very lionized figure, these are mass-produced works, already massively technologically mediated. Quite different, I think, from the Wardrops. But the Wardrops were very self-consciously obsolete. They were anachronisms in their own time. The postman, for instance, would know that he could never ring their bell because they would work through the night and would only get up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And this was known to all around. Books would arrive, whole boxes of books would arrive from Europe sort of once a week, and you would have to come round afterwards at 3 o'clock. But these were sort of weird sorts of figures who didn't exist in this world so much. Not so much technologically reproduced artworks for them. Still belong to that idea. But think of how unusual they were. When they die, that whole model of being, if they're the last people alive to do this. Maybe there are other people. But they're always individual and not very... You can't make a theory of art based out of them. They're the anachronisms. This is where we stand now. So this idea of the here and now of the work of art. Technological reproducibility, says Benjamin, changes the relationship between subject and object. We know this in some sense from literature, because we know that, let's say, when Jane Austen sits down to write, that sense of she doesn't know her readership. Technological reproduction has already changed the relationship. The poet who used to write for her, or more particularly his patron, is not Jane Austen. Jane Austen is writing to a readership which is quite large, which she doesn't know. The relationship between subject and object has been between the consumer, between writer, producer and consumer has changed. So Benjamin is interested in two dimensions here. First, he says that the technologically reproduced artwork messes with the naturalistic schema of perception. It can bring out aspects of the original that are accessible only to the lens, which is adjustable and can easily change viewpoint, but not to the human eye. So here, a massive microscopic close-up, let's say, of a crustacean. Things here which you can't see naturalistically. The technologically reproduced artwork allows this to become new. So what is the scale of the technologically reproduced artwork? So this is in terms of space, in some sense, of what you can see, distance, and so on. It also does things, he says, and to time. Through enlargement or slow motion, it can record images which escape not natural optics altogether. I've always been struck by this. This is a Scandi Noir program from a couple of years ago called The Legacy. Anybody watch that? I thought it was dreadful, actually, but the opening is one that gets much quoted in contemporary, more popular. So if you look here just at the way in which technological reproducibility, the ability to freeze, in slow motion particularly, that's of interest. These are the opening credits. So here, notice also not only the slow motion, the repetitions, but also the reversibility. Sometimes you see things coming together, sometimes you see them falling apart. All technologically mediated, therefore escaping naturalistic perception is what's doing. So when writers begin, what is the analog in writing? If you think of the ideas of a kind of psychological drama, of the ways in which, let's say, madness or stress are written in the modernist work, that particular sense in which things which would never have been part of a literary form. Think of think of Ulysses, a 600-700 page novel which deals with a single unexceptional day. Enlargement, extension, these ideas of the transformation of space and time in some way become part of modernist writing for us. So modernist work or the technologically reproduced work, says Benjamin, can also place the copy of the original in situations in which the original itself cannot attain. He says this enables the original to meet the recipient halfway, whether in the form of a photograph or in that of a gramophone record. And of course, we would scroll forward through to contemporary forms of musical composition here. Think then, let's say, of the Da Vinci's Last Supper, which is housed in the refectory of the convent of Santa Maria delle Grazie in Milan. But that sense of those of us who have never been to Milan, I haven't, have never therefore seen this sense. The peculiar individual relationship to this work of art, which is part of its aura, says Benjamin, is not capturable by any of us. We have here a photographic or a technologically mediated reproduction of it. Interestingly enough, of course, because for Benjamin, the aura of a work includes all that is historically transmissible, all of its forms of ownership. And the key point about this painting, one of the key points about this painting, is that it didn't exist anymore. They tried to restore it over and over again, but in fact the restorations, A, change it, and B, are not working anyway. The work is actually becoming invisible the longer we go on. It's hard, here aspects of it are drawn out, you can actually see it's the Last Supper. In the original, apparently, you can't see that really at all. You stare at it and it's very murky and very dark. All of that for Benjamin is that works of art are historical things for him, but not the technologically reproduced work, which isn't. So due to the methods used, a variety of environmental factors and intentional damage, very little of the original painting remains today, despite numerous restoration attempts. Just recently of Banksy's staging of this with kind of self-destruction of one of his own works. Notice also what happens, of course, to the Last Supper, that sense in which it enters into, through technological mediation, into the capitalist landscape. So a mug, a tray, and that rather nice idea of the Last Supper, therefore you do need after-dinner mints. Of course, with it. What withers in the age of technological reproducibility is the latter's aura, says Benjamin. So we're talking about detraditionalization, the shattering of tradition, he suggests. Aura implies authenticity, but there is no authenticity without its destruction in mechanical reproducibility. Here we move the girl with the golden earring or whatever the film was called. So what then is the aura? It's a tremendously difficult category to get your head around. Benjamin describes it as a strange tissue of time and space, the unique apparition of a distance, however near it may be. When you contemplate the Alps as a romantic poet, you can be right up there with them, but that strange, the sublime, indicates a kind of a distance. Whether you see that in terms of religiosity in some sense, the awe, for instance, that you might experience, the apperception of a distance in some ways. Aura then, for Benjamin, either is or requires a kind of gap. There has to be a gap between subject and the object in some ways, a distance. Aura is a projective, also intersubjectivity, he says, governed by depth and interiority, active looking and reciprocity. To perceive the aura of an object we look at means to invest it with the ability to look at us in return. It's a peculiar notion, this, but in some sense, in examining the Mona Lisa, for instance, we imagine her looking back at us and seeing us. That sense of we invest it with personhood or subjectivity and see ourselves as being seen by it. That's involved in the idea of aura. But in the mechanically or the technologically reproduced artwork, that doesn't exist anymore. People found it difficult when film was first becoming popularized because they imagined that they found it very difficult to act for film, actors and person, because they were used to, as it were, meeting the audience in this particular way, where a significant look, for instance. But in film, where do you look? You're looking at the apparatus as the actor. The apparatus is not human. The first thing that the camera does is to make you aware of the fact that you're not actually playing to an audience, you're playing to a camera, which is a thing. And therefore the camera then, of course, objectifies you in turn. And actors had to learn that. But when we see films, you know, when we see Scarlett Johansson, for instance, or Greta Garbo, whoever it would be across the history of film, we don't imagine them looking back at us in turn. Even when they look at us, as it were, that look at us is always technologically mediated, and we know that. Let me just focus for a moment on some attempts in art to address this sort of problem and how sometimes they fail. Think about a figure like Rodchenko in Russia and the Soviet Union immediately after the revolution, where Rodchenko attempted to argue that we have to do away with likenesses in some sense, with the attempt to capture people as though they were real. You'll know Rodchenko's works here very often, and trying to describe as a kind of movement, something which resists active contemplation for him was tremendously important. Here also Popova's work. You'll see this whole project of supremacism or futurism, the various kinds of work that became very popular. Notice the echo of the Taklin building in Rodchenko's model there on the left. This is how art ought to be in technologically reproduced forms. We must revolutionize our optical perception. We must remove the veil from our eyes, he said. The veil was the veil of illusion, as it were, the veil of what gets called the real. Realism is past for Rodchenko. You know, that would be, realism would be reactionary. You must not try to be realistic. You must try to create the future in some sense. And only the camera seems to be capable of describing one life. The tremendous importance of it. And for Benjamin, not only the camera, I would say, buildings as well, but also advertising. Advertising which grasps hold of something evanescent and makes it as though it were more fundamental. But then there are great difficulties around this. Look at, so here, Rodchenko's famous portrait of Lilia Brick. And I mean, there's an irony to this piece, obviously, where she's, anybody can read Russian? What? You're all fluent in Russian? I thought every known language. So she's shouting out, books, she's shouting, on every conceivable subject, or in every conceivable subject. And of course she's a worker, so she's talking about mass education. But as you know from Franz Ferdinand, if not from advertising, how quickly this thing becomes appropriated. So there the Rodchenko, there the Franz Ferdinand first album, was it? I can't remember. And here, very often we see these kinds of slogans in advertising, say yes to something or other. Saying yes is exactly what Lilia Brick was not doing in that piece. She was saying books, in other words, say no in some sense, learn. But here, the steady, as it were, appropriation of that work. Technologically reproduced work can itself become technologically reproduced. So Benjamin talks about the social basis of the present decay. And he says it rests on two circumstances, which are both linked to the increasing emergence of the masses and the growing intensity of their movements. So we're talking about the huge movement of proletarianization, if you like, but the emergence also of a mass consumer market, of an active, militant, socially engaged working class. Also something that very much involves the admission of women into the workforce in large numbers. Tremendous change in the early years of the century. He speaks, I've been working with two definitions of the German here. The one says, the desire of the present day masses to get closer to things. And the masses' equally passionate concern for overcoming each thing's uniqueness. The other translation speaks of the proletariat's desire to bring things closer the proletariat's sense of the universal equality of things. You understand those, the second one at least, the idea of the universal equality of things, the breaking down of the idea of irreducible individuality. We know that that's the language of commodification speaking. Commodities are all alike, in one sense at least, which is that they all have prices. They all have exchange value. They are no longer, as it were, radically unique and untransmissible. All of them speak the same language. So there's something profoundly democratic about this idea of commodification. Paradoxically, because of course commodification is for Marx the riddle of capitalist society, in some way the secret of capitalist society. But this peculiar sense in which the, if you take things out of their use value and make them into commodity objects, they speak a common language. And this is, the working class, Benjamin says, understands this common language because it is also a commodity on the market. You sell your labor power on the market. In going out to work, the first thing you do is you make yourself into a commodity object. So of course, to you this makes sense, and you see it as the way forward in some way. But you're also attempting then to bring things closer. So you're putting, the way in which you respond to the culture of the past, is you put the fun half or wherever it is, on your, it's there on your screen, it's there on your wall. You bring it closer, you take it out of the museum, and bring it closer. You're breaking with the old notion of use value or the cultic ritual value of art. Benjamin says that in fact you also need to do something else, which is to break with the exchange value of works. He says at one place that in fact the best ways to build up a book collection, he says, firstly, are to write all the books yourself. But then he reckons that even if you write a lot, you can only, how many books do you write in a career? Even if you're J.K. Rowling, it's only about 30. That's not very big. Next best thing, he says, is to steal the books. Or if not steal them, at least borrow them with no intention of returning them to their owners. And the key point, he says, is that that these books for you have a certain kind of relationship. You make them yours in some way. Never alphabetize your collection. The very worst way to arrange books on a shelf, he says, is to put them in alphabetical order. That just makes them functional objects. What you have to do is to put them in a memory order, or an order of your own habit. I got this one when I was in this place, seeing this girl, whatever it was. This one I got in a different way, it reminds me of my mother. This one I stole at this place, as it were. This one when I went on a trip to find something but found something else. Only you can understand the order of your books. You have this peculiar relationship to them. They are commodities, but you are, as it were, decommodifying them. You're not reading. Also, don't read the books. Only about 10% of the books on your shelves should you read. In fact, I've tried this actually all my life. I never get to as many as 10%, but count how many books there are in each shelf you have. And if there are more than 10% that you've read, you must reorganize them. So that's not a good shelf. Reorganize them so that they are only 10% maximum on one shelf. And that's the best way to have a collection, he says. Just when I was getting going. So that anyway, there's more to be said. We must focus on the question of aura tomorrow, so that's what we'll start with.